VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. On today's show, we'll be looking back on an epic weekend of FA Cup action at Wembley, where there was heartbreak for Coventry City and more slapstick comedy from Manchester United. We'll be discussing the latest twists in the Premier League relegation battle, including the hotly anticipated deduction derby at Goodison Park, and the revelation, thanks to Nottingham Forest's intrepid official Twitter account, of a Luton Town sleeper agent in the VAR booth at Stockley Park. And we'll also be checking in on the race for the Premier League title, which Arsenal and Liverpool are not giving up on without a fight. No Tom Clark today, so you've got me, Gregor Robertson, and joining me today we have the Times sports writer and Sunday Times columnist Alison Rudd, the former Chelsea and Aston Villa striker Tony Cascarino, and the author of the Trend column, full of tactical insights, which lands on the Times website every Wednesday morning, Hamza Khalik Lunat. Right. Only one place to start, and I have to be honest, I am still an emotional wreck after being at Wembley yesterday to see Coventry City 3, Manchester United 3.
Did you cup your ear to the Coventry fans, especially the children, as if to let them know that they came up against
not.
Real Premier League class?
I most certainly did not. I was just telling the panel, dear listeners, that I was sitting right at the end of the press box, and next to some Coventry City fans, and there were so many children in tears around me when they scored the equaliser, and then, you know, more tears of pure joy when they scored what they thought was the winner, and then more tears still when it all went wrong on penalty kicks.
What's the difference between tears of joy and tears of angst, would you say?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I think you can just see the pain on the face, I think, at the end, and it was, although still real pride. I also tweeted, I very rarely tweet, but I tweeted the stark contrast between the vast kind of swathes of empty seats just minutes after the final whistle in the winning end of the stadium, Manchester United's end, and then the contrast between that and the sky blue flags fluttering with like real pride at their players in the loser's end, which was, I think, kind of summed up a lot about not just this game but also kind of where the FA Cup is at, maybe.
Do you think Anthony woke up this morning embarrassed that he did that celebration, cupping his ear to the...
I definitely think he should because we have to be honest, rest of Manchester United players deserve a bit of credit for not celebrating wildly and actually kind of showing their respect to the Coventry players after a remarkable fight. So what can we say about this game? What can we say? I think we'll come to Coventry. What can we say about Manchester United? They're finding new ways, as I say, to kind of entertain us, but with slapstick sort of capitulations and defending at times as well, Tony.
Yeah, there's a lot of Groundhog Day in there, that's for sure. You know, if you want to take the bigger picture and their season as a whole, it's based on really bad performances in the Champions League, a very indifferent Premier League, you know, campaign. League Cup out in the fourth round. And then there's this semi-final yesterday, which, I'll be honest, I watched it till 3-0, switched it over to Liverpool-Fulham, thinking, I'm going to watch Liverpool now, it's done and dusted. But I'll check the game, check it, it was 3-2. Now I'm hooked on watching, obviously, Coventry versus Manchester United and just thinking, if they get their third and they go to extra time, Coventry are going to win it. I was convinced they were going to win it. And obviously then there was the goal that was disallowed, that was, yes, rightly so, just marginally offside. Then Ellis Sims hit in the bar, and it just felt it was one of the most roller coaster emotional games I think I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot with all, you know, 43 years in football, and take even adding into being a teenager watching all this football over the years. I can't remember, you know, I started thinking of Newcastle versus Arsenal at 4-4 and that, how dramatic that was that day at St James's Park. I think this eclipsed it, because it was a Championship team taking on the might of a club of Manchester United. But Manchester United are not that club anymore. No. They are as a revenue, but if you look at their team and the mess and how indifferent so many players are, I mean, Casemiro, wow. I mean, playing at centre-half, I thought before the game, I actually said, really, if he's alongside Maguire, because that's the only choice, if anyone runs behind him, and there were a few incidents in the game where he, I mean, I think, who referee, Gary Neville, was it Gary, who was doing the commentary in the game? It was Lee Dixon. He referenced that he was pulling a milk van or something, you know, and I was thinking, yeah, the parachute on the back. I was thinking all the quotes of, you know, if you're lacking pace, boy.
In fairness, though, he was hardly tested for an hour.
No.
He made one really good sliding tackle, but then, you know, the game's just sparked into life. It was obviously
Can
matches.
I ask, just in general, for everybody here, would you say that Man United look a very fit team? I don't mean with injuries and all that. I mean, actually, the condition of their team.
It's hard to differentiate, I would say, between mental and physical fitness. Mm. Because I think if you're not working well as a unit, and there are doubts about the future of the management team and so on, that can have an effect on the effort you put in, which makes you look physically tired when you might in fact be physically okay, but you're not. You need impetus and motivation to make yourself run further than your body wants you to.
Yeah.
So when I look at United, I see a team that don't look fit, physically fit, but I suspect it's because of they're not mentally fit.
Yeah, that's it after the Bournemouth game last week as well. Their body language is just shocking. So it's like,
yeah.
I think Alisson's right. It's like a cycle that kind of one feeds into the other. Even when they went out for extra time, you just looked at they just all looked completely dejected. And like, you saw Diego Dalot was the only player who was trying to G people up, and everyone else was just kind of staring at the floor. So, and Coventry had chances before that. They hit the bar, and then what about this moment then? This, you know, Victor Torp's. What would have been an iconic, you know, all-time great FA Cup moment, and it was taken away by VAR. Hamza, what did you make of that moment?
It was offside.
Oh God!
I mean, you're going to be a bit sad about it, but it was offside. And if we really sort of go into it, there's probably a good chance that the linesman realised it might have been offside and just went, I'm actually going to hold my flag down so the VAR can check. In which case,
can we be sure? Can we be absolutely certain that was offside?
Well, you can have a margin of error and you can go, actually, yeah.
But is that margin of error worth it in a game of this magnitude and for a moment like that to be taken away despite there being a margin of error?
I think it's an acceptable margin of error. And if it was the other way around, and let's say, for example, Manchester United scored and it was ruled offside, then you go, oh, actually, for the Coventry fans, that's worked out quite well. I mean, yeah, sure, it's not very nice, but as you mentioned to all those kids, like, welcome to football, you're going to have a lifetime of this. So.
Okay, we've just discovered that Hamza has no heart. Alison, come on, help me out here.
No, I mean, I agree with your sentiment, Gregor, because you are left thinking, if you were a Hamza and you thought, well, the truth is the truth, and there's no point dwelling on it, we have a fact in front of us, that's fine. It didn't feel like the truth. It didn't feel like just... The reason VAR exists is to stop fans leaving the stadium feeling that an injustice has occurred. I do not think, as probably a lot of United fans were included, but every Coventry fan and every neutral watching on telly, were left feeling with, in the pit of their stomach, a sense that there had been an act of injustice, because it was a very, very one of the tightest offsides you'll see.
A toenail, and as Mark Robin said.
I mean, that might be generous. It was probably half a toenail.
That is fundamentally football, though, right? Injustices all over. I mean, who did we watch the other day? Manchester United played Liverpool twice, and somehow three times this season, and somehow Liverpool didn't win any of them. I mean, just looking at those three matches as footballing spectacles, all three were injustices. But that is what we accept football is. It's a low-scoring game. Sometimes, often, the best team doesn't win. Sometimes stuff goes the other way and it's unfair. But yeah,
you can always accept an injustice if it's just because of the ebb and flow of a football match. I think it's when it's one specific moment and when technology is the thing that's intervened.
We're not talking about feeling hard done to because your team played the nicer football but didn't win. We're talking about the reason VAR exists is supposed to stop us dwelling on moments like this.
I don't think that's entirely true. Like, that's one reason why VAR exists. And I think, as you just mentioned, specific moments. All games are a collection of specific moments. This just happens to be one that didn't go Coventry's way. I think it's entirely normal and fair that they don't get that goal. Should have just been onside, I guess. It's a harsh reading, but entirely correct one in my view.
Well, it's not entirely correct, though, is it? You can't prove to me mathematically and philosophically that is the truth that we witnessed, that he was offside. It was close enough for the spirit of football to have prevailed, and it didn't, because VAR has decided they've got this magic tool of these lines that we've already seen. If you draw them, you can draw straight lines from different angles and from different parts of the body, and it does become blurred.
I'm not going to get into truths because I'll get sued, cornered again.
But isn't it the reason why football is so popular, and because it's so controversial and it's so emotional? You know, you can go back to 66 and the goal even today, was that a goal? You know, when England won the World Cup. You know, there are incidences that sometimes happen. There is no margin. There is no real margin. Yesterday, you could easily say, you know, the advantage for forwards was that if you're level, as I'm seeing the line, I'm still thinking, as I'm looking at it, thinking, he still looks level.
He's entirely level in the spirit of what football is, which is he's not gaining an advantage by being in an offside position. He's not gaining an advantage over the defender.
No, but then there's
he's level with the defender.
The factual side is that they're saying that they can prove, even by the minutest of margins, he's offside.
Well, I've yet to see evidence that minutiae is accurate enough for us all to have faith in it as the truth.
Indeed.
They have baked in the margin of error, though. So this season, what they did is, you don't get to see it on the monitor and the image that they display, but if the lines are touching in the VAR booth, then they give the benefit of the doubt to the attacker, because that's the margin of error. Just when they draw it on for sort of public consumption, that's where you get to see these thicker lines. So they've actually baked in a sort of margin of error. Whether we believe that the actual camera technology is good enough is a different question, and I'd probably side with you guys on that, because I don't think the frame capture rate is high enough, but I don't think anyone really wants to hear about frame capture rate.
Well, I think they'd have loved to have heard about it if they were allowed to vote about it when the goal went in.
Crikey, we're going down a slippery slope now. Football throws up controversies, but we don't need democracy for this.
let's say we're probably going to have this sort of discussion regurgitated somewhere again along the show.
That's the thing, yeah.
It's what football is. I saw.
Yeah, but this is different, Tony. It feels like there's always been controversy in football, but this is like another added layer to it. And it felt like this, for me, it felt like this weekend, on top of a few things combined for me. We're going to come in to talk about FA Cup replays being scrapped. Mm. This moment, which, you know, there was a lot of despair among even neutral fans about this moment. I even did a piece at the weekend about speaking to fans of clubs who are trying to be promoted to the Premier League, who don't want to be promoted. They feel like
because their great year were like Southampton and the West Ham. I think if you speak to West Ham fans, I think Alan Pardew was the manager. That was one of their finest years. They loved it.
Yeah, I mean, West Ham are a bit different than they're a big enough club to be, you know, sustaining Premier League football. But this felt like there's something a little bit broken this weekend, I thought. I don't know if I'm being too downhearted about this, but anyway, it was a remarkable, dramatic game. Finally, you know, Martin Samuels, the headline in his column is, Manchester United are like a clown car with the brakes off. Not even the final may save Ten Hag. Finally, does this feel like, despite the victory, it was a kind of final nail in the coffin for Eric Ten Hag?
Yeah.
Well, one day it'll be a riddle. When was a victory not a victory? And it'll be this match.
Yeah.
Because they came out of it with United. I mean, they took a three The only thing that surprised me in your summary of the game, Tony, was that you said it was 3-0 to United and you turned over thinking it was done and dusted. I did not think at that point it was done and dusted, which is an indictment of how United have been playing this season.
Well, Liverpool are now.
We're coming to them at the end of the show today, all right, guys?
We're meant to be fans. I said it because, look, and you're right, there is a point to this that this is Keystone Cops Manchester United. This is what they are. And it's a hard one for United supporters to take because they're witnessing a team capitulate nearly in every scenario. Now, they've done it in games. They've had Bournemouth at home and fall apart at Old Trafford. And you're thinking, you know, again, you take the FA Cup tie against Liverpool and how dramatic it all was. Seems like Man United can't have a bog-standard 2-0 win and nothing else was, you know, just a game where they won comfortably and you moved on. They don't have them games.
No. Well, still a day to remember for Coventry City fans. And yeah, the cynic in me actually did think when the winning penalty went in for Manchester United that they maybe have... It was maybe a blessing in disguise not having to face Manchester City and lose 7-0 in the final or something, you know. Anyway.
By the way, just one quick little thing. Does anyone have a problem with the way some of the conduct of the players are getting a little bit involved with the Coventry players as they were going up to take their penalty? Because there was words being said. Fernandez said a few words and so did Onana. There was things said and I thought, well, OK, that's fine enough. I wouldn't mind that if it was a Man City versus Manchester United. Because they're two huge clubs, the stature. But when it's Coventry and you're in a penalty shootout and I just thought it was a bit below the mark for me. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong on that one. But
no,
I just...
United got lots of things wrong and one of them was they didn't have any class. That's one of the things you do as the bigger club.
And
United
is you're
supposed to show some
that.
Class.
Yeah.
Okay, I think time to move on to the other semi-final, Hamza, which you were at. Bernardo Silva's 84th minute goal. Put City into the final 3 days after bowing out of the Champions League to Real Madrid. Chelsea had their chances again at Wembley. Johnny Northcroft wrote in his piece in the Sunday Times that he thinks a gang of therapists might have to descend on Cobham to exercise the Wembley hoodoo that this young team are experiencing. What did you make of the game, Hamza?
It was all right. I often get asked this question, what do you think of the match? And most matches usually just fall in the sort of bracket of, yeah, fine. There's a few matches that are genuinely special and a few matches that are diabolical. But yeah, it was all right. City were all right. Chelsea were probably better. Nicholas Jackson missed a few opportunities and he didn't even get a shot with one of them. It wasn't particularly high quality.
Your piece today, the headline is "Functional, not formidable." Why Manchester City lack vintage fizz? So you're suggesting that they're kind of ploughing through with experience and guts as opposed to the flair of recent seasons, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, like so the Monday piece is always meant to be a sort of like a thoughtful piece that you're sort of throwing forward to agenda setting, as some people may say. Not to set at a specific agenda, but sorry, I
keep
need
digging.
To clarify that. What I thought was interesting in this match was that City weren't that good, and I don't think they've been particularly good by their own standards over the past season and a half. I think the team was utterly formidable in 2017-18, spectacular in 18-19, sensational in 21-22 when they got 100 points, 98 points and 93 points respectively. And they played in a way that was just gorgeous, dominant, and it was provocative. You watch them play and you go, I haven't seen that before. I don't know how you're doing that. It's amazing. And then when you watch City this season or last season, I know they won the treble and they might win the double. I just don't see a team that is as dominant, that is as special. I just see a team that is more stubborn. And that's not a sort of negative comment. It's just a characteristic of them. They're older, they're wearier, they're a bit more stubborn. The way they get through matches is through this stubbornness. Yeah, they might rack up 6 goals against a few teams, but not with the same sort of panache and style that they used to. And in this match in particular, they just sort of ground their way through. The only issue I think that may arise is that there are moments where you saw stubbornness as a quality is not something that can be relied upon for the long term. So it's great and it helps you win trophies. And that's why they won the treble last year, and it's why they may win the treble this year. But when I looked at Kyle Walker and Kevin De Bruyne in particular, I saw excellent players that are beyond their peak now, that have declined a bit. And De Bruyne had this amazing pass where he slipped Foden in, but that was probably the best moment of his match. And if you go back a few seasons ago, he would probably have three or four sensational passes. Kyle Walker made a few errors. He made a few errors against Real Madrid too. And his pace got him back inside to stop and to put Nicholas Jackson off balance for one of those instances. But the positional sort of sense that he used to have, that he had, sort of faded a bit. So I think that the City are probably the best team in Europe. But
haven't said all that.
Yeah. But as in, are they as good as they used to be? No. And if they want to get that good again or get better than that, then they have to sort of probably make some hard decisions and think about how they're going to replace Walker and De Bruyne and a few other players. But yeah, they're going to probably win the league, but that's more an indictment of the quality of this league compared to the quality of, let's say, the 1920 league when they didn't, or when they needed to get 98 points to win the league. But yeah,
that I'm was glad Amza didn't watch me and you play.
No, yeah.
Well, it was, you made some great points, by the way, Amza.
Yeah,
well.
No, I think all the truth. Both things can be true. Both things can be true. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah,
Amza's called, you know, some shots that are right. You know, of course, Kevin De Bruyne and Kyle Walker are not the players they were, which were spectacular, and they are in their 30s now. You referenced a beautiful game, and that is basically what it was with City. You know, we've seen teams like Barcelona, Ajax, and even if you go back to Frank Rijkaard's and Johan Cruyff's Barcelona, they were beautiful teams to watch. This City team now has become very functional. Chelsea will be kicking themselves. And I was talking to my friend about
this. Kick themselves but miss.
No, but yeah, fair point, Al. I would say as well that I realise as a centre-forward at times that I joined Aston Villa, and we had a chance of winning the title, and there was 10 games to go, and I got 2 goals in them 10 games, and I was brought in to hopefully give them the nudge, which didn't work out, to win the title, but be clinical. If you're going to play for the biggest clubs, you have to be clinical. A goalkeeper will be criticised. We'll all sit here and go, he should save that. You know, someone scores and we'll go straight away, we'll go. And a coach once said to me, he doesn't save, it's the same as you missing. And that's where Nicholas Jackson in. He's like a goalkeeper that's getting beaten, but with an effort you think he should save. Mm. Okay? And they're the same things. They're still mistakes. And it can be a bit harsh because goalkeepers are scrutinised more than anybody. But so are centre-forwards. Because if you're not clinical, it was my thing with Nunes. It was my thing with Timo Werner. It was my thing with Lukaku at Chelsea when he didn't look clinical. And I think you have to understand, you know, we can all say, oh, he's covering every blade of grass and always working his socks off and, you know, and he never stops getting in the position. But the biggest thing about a centre-forward, and I'm talking from Chelsea's perspective, if you're not clinical, you're not doing your job.
Ali, what about this idea of Chelsea as a young kind of developing team needing to break this kind of duck to do something, to win the first piece of silverware, to kind of take the next step and maybe flourish or blossom more? Do you think there's any truth in that, or
it would have been nice, wouldn't it? I mean, it would have helped enormously had they defeated City, then gone on to trounce United in the final, and no doubt would have added a element of camaraderie which they're missing, unity, sense that the project that Pochettino bangs on about actually exists. But I'm not sure that stacks up completely, because their best player by the hugest of margins is Cole Palmer, and he's really, really young, and he's probably going to win Young Player of the Year, and he seems to me a very switched on young man who realised what you need most as a player is game time, wasn't getting it at City, agitated for a move, wasn't prepared to listen to, oh, but if you stay with Pep, you'll become a better player. He thought, well, I'm good enough, thank you. Has gone to Chelsea, which are necessarily, they are in a way understandably malfunctioning a bit because of all the change in personnel and ownership and management. And they have too few leaders, that's often said. It's why, actually, when you're at a Chelsea game or listening to the fans, they just sing Thiago Silva's name over and over again because they see in him someone who might knit it together, give them a bit of gravitas, add a bit of maturity to a performance. But as I say, it's undermined by the fact the very, very best player they have is Cole Palmer, who is stunning to watch, absolutely stunning. And they should feel in some way that the managerial trick here, the coach should be able to take him and say, look, if we all work to what we know he can do, to the balls he can play to you, our shape should be built around you. He should be played where he's most effective, most comfortable. They should shift his position within games. He disappears within games. That's down to Pochettino. He should say to him, no, you can have a 2 second rest, but really, you are the main man. Get more involved. They sometimes look lightweight when he's having those little breathers he has, because he is a superstar in the making. So it's there. I think the excuse that they're too young is just trotted out too often. They've chosen to be young, and you've got to exploit it. And being young is a good thing in sport, because you've just been telling us, Hamza, how very old some of the stars of the game are.
Ancient, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's all about youth. So, and no body fat. Youth and no body fat. And so, yes, whilst it would have helped Pochettino enormously over the summer if they'd been able to win the FA Cup, I don't think youth is not a great excuse, because their best player is so young.
Hamza, you've watched Chelsea now twice in a week, because you were at the Everton game as well, weren't you?
Yeah. On Palmer, I think he's developing into... I did a piece a few months ago about where have all the number 10s gone, and mostly they're playing as number 8s or as a sort of inside forward on the wing. But every now and then a number 10 comes along and goes, that's a genuine number 10. When Jude Bellingham, you see that. And I think there's been a discussion for a long time. Who should also play number 10 with Jude, or who should play instead of Jude? First of all, what a stupid conversation, because Jude Bellingham, who just scored the winner in El Clasico, is quite clearly head and shoulders the best number 10 in the world. But if there is to be a second choice, if Jude is unavailable, there's a conversation, should it be Foden or something? It's quite clearly Palmer, in my opinion. The way that he interprets space and manipulates space and moves into between the lines or outside of the shape that the opponents are taking up to instigate play is as a conventional number 10 would do it. He's fantastic. He has his sense of rhythm, of tempo, when to slow the game down, when to speed it up. In fact, he was actually, to come back to Jackson, he was throughout the match trying to guide Jackson, about how to press in the 4-4-2 shape and how to cover Rodri. And Jackson was terrible, because Jackson just didn't want to do it. He always wanted to cheat and sort of get ahead early, so that if his teammates won the ball behind him, he'd be able to run in behind, which happened on a couple of occasions. And the one time that he sort of rounded the keeper, he didn't take a shot. So it's all well and good sort of cheating, but you've got to sort of show your worth when you do it. But to compare him with Foden, there was this moment, I think in the 88th, 89th minute, unreal, where the anger that Guardiola displayed. So Foden had the ball, he forced a pass forward to Alvarez, and he just shouldn't have done that. City were winning 1-0, there was an easy pass in infield, it could have just gone wide and wasted time, as De Bruyne did by heading to the corner. But no, he forced the ball forwards, and I've never seen Guardiola this angry. He did this sort of crab-like dance where he stuck his fingers to his head and sort of squatted and ran onto the pitch. And it would have been funny if not for the sheer anger that was emanating from him. He was screaming at Foden. And Foden, for the first 5 seconds, just didn't dare turn. And then he did. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he did, Guardiola slammed his fingers into his head. And he's just screaming, use your brain. And Foden turned away. And he just kept screaming. And that is something...
And this is the player he says is the best in the Premier League.
And I think this isn't like...
It's not just you that's harsh, Hamza.
This isn't some... major sort of attack on Fred. It's just that I think where Palmer is ahead of him is in the emotional reading of matches and when to slow the game down and when to attack. And I think that skill is one that De Bruyne has and Palmer has and Foden hasn't yet honed. And that may be one reason why he hasn't been picked infield as much for City or infield as much for England. And I think that emotional awareness, that acuity to read matches and know when and where and what to do in a particular moment is what makes the very best number 10s. And I think Palmer has that, and I think he demonstrated that throughout the match.
So do you think it's inevitable then that Palmer looks like he's not putting in a shift because of that intuition? Because he does sometimes disappear, so Chelsea look like they're a man shy when they're not in possession, for example.
I think some of that might have to do with Jackson not tracking his players properly. I personally don't see that too much. I think he puts a fair effort in. A lot of players have that sort of languid nature to the way that they play and they run, and often the accusation is thrown at them.
There's a word, isn't there, that type of player can sometimes look a stroller, you know, where you think, and they're not. You know, there have been players that are not strollers, but they sometimes slow it down in a moment and see something quite differently, and De Bruyne was the king of that. I mean, I used to think Hazard in a different way, because he'd set up from a standing start, but he'll slow the game and suddenly just burst into life. And when he was at his very best, he saw that every picture that was available for him. That was one of his strengths. It's an interesting one, because Foden is obviously a top-quality player, but there is something very different about Kyle Palmer.
Well, I'm sure we'll return to that many, many times between now and
the Euros. What sums up the game, though, is my nephew, who's a Manchester City fan, came all the way down from Lancashire, stayed with me, went to Wembley, came home, and he was most excited about the fact that a bloke sat next to him, threw a pint of beer over another bloke because the bloke was on his phone and not watching the game.
Modern football.
That's modern football.
There you go. Finally, on the FA Cup, the weekend had begun with the story that replays are being axed, as we mentioned earlier. And the headline in Martin Ziegler's piece was "Spineless FA facing EFL revolt after axing replays." This is because the Football League insists that there was no agreement in place before the change was announced, and fans were being encouraged to protest. And a lot of clubs did make a bit of noise about this. You had a lovely little piece in the paper today, Tony, about, you know, which underlined how important replays can be to a club. Can you tell us about that?
Well, just I got caught up in France with a different system. So, you know, going abroad, and I'm talking about the cup games, and then I'm finding out, you know, we're doing the French Cup, and it's, well, we could get Réunion or Tahiti away and all this, and thinking replay. But they did settle ties in one game. But they also gave the opportunity, if you were separated by more than one league, you could play the away game. It was a choice that was given to the minnow, not the big club. So I always found that really intriguing and quite exciting. But the French Cup wasn't deemed as big as the League Cup in France. It was a smaller trophy. But to me, the League Cup, you know, the FA Cup is something that stays with me. I had three games against Everton. I missed a sitter in the second game in extra time with minutes to go. Neville Southall, 1-1, a bit like Nicholas Jackson's of the weekend. And I put it wide of the goal. We'd gone to Goodison. We drew 0-0. We'd come back to Priestfield at Gillingham. And it was 0-0. And the second period of extra time, I've got a 1-1. I'm left all on my own. It was a really weird moment. I can still picture myself now. I looked around and I thought, if someone just boots the ball forward, I'm on my own. Everton had literally put everybody up front. And John Sitton, I think it's John Sitton who played the ball, just smashed it. I'm away on a 1-1. And it was like an eternity. It was like a dream. I was in slow motion. I'm running to Southall. I could see this big player, because Neville was big. He was a big goalkeeper. And I'm thinking, and I've just put it wide at a post. And we end up having a third game at Priestfield because we tossed the coin. So it's not only a replay, it's a second replay.
Yeah, that's a bit too far. No one's come back. No one's advocating me go back to that.
But we lost 3-0 in the third game. I'm all for replays, but I really feel like, how are you going to jig this where you can keep the fairy tale of what it is for so many clubs, the FA Cup, especially going down in the tiers of football, which I think is special, because no country has as many tears as us with the support that's out there and the love of the FA Cup. It's enormous in this country. And I just kept thinking, the French system could work here. It really could. Because I know there'll be some that say, and I think a French team won the cup, a lower league team won the cup a few years back. They chose to have all their games at home. And they got
that's the thing. If
and I'm not saying anyone could do that, but
that's the thing. This is, you know, this is a story that's in the Times today about the potential to emulate that. Essentially, that
I didn't know that was in the thinking. I just
conversations, yeah. And whether it would what happened or who knows. But we were discussing before. It almost that means that the smaller teams, if they get a plum tie, have got the choice between, you know, probably having a better chance of going through, so the sport and endeavour side of things are taking the money.
Yeah,
and that's not a good position to be put in.
It completely ruin the draw. So you put your hand in the bag and you pull out a number and you say, well, it might be Old Trafford or it might not be Old Trafford. It's just, if you believe in fate, if you believe in luck, if you believe in, you can't suddenly introduce an element of choice into it. It ruins the whole point of the draw.
Well, I liked it. The players loved it. The fans loved it in France, and there
That's the French tradition. No,
I would say that there were a number of clubs that chose to play at home to have that opportunity as well.
But there's a more like fundamental question at play here too. Why is the football calendar in English football being shaped to suit six clubs as opposed to 92 plus? Can we answer that question?
Well, it's Champions League, isn't it? It's the Champions League football. It's the teams that are having the ability to win the competition. That's what it comes down to.
Well, there's also there's a clash. The Swiss system has bullied another week in the calendar.
Yep. I'm not sure the clubs wanted that. That was more UEFA. And I think I'm very briefly just going to touch on the Super League, because one of the great shames of the Super League moment was that in everyone sort of coalescing against the Super League, they implicitly coalesced around FIFA and UEFA. But FIFA and UEFA have very, very rarely ever looked out for clubs or their supporters. I mean, you look at the location of the Europa League, Baku, Chelsea, Arsenal, yeah. Or if you look at the treatment of fans in the 2022 Paris final, or I can't remember where Rangers played their match, but for the Europa final, but there wasn't water there. UEFA have shown constant disregard for supporters. FIFA are going to play a World Cup over several tournaments, have expanded their Club World Cup. Clubs should be able to resist this, but they just can't, because that's where the money is. And if you want to compete, you need the money so you can have better players. And it's the incentives of this system are totally broken. I mean, coming back to the FA Cup, right? The idea here that clubs need their money to survive or to have ambition is just totally broken. Like, why do we have a situation where a small club is thinking, oh, I could play Manchester United at home and we might actually have something really interesting and fun here. We bring them to our patch and whatever. Or we go there and we get the gate receipts because they've got 80,000 capacity and that'll be amazing for us. I mean, that's just a terrible sort of perverse incentives, and that's not how we should build the footballing system in this country. You come to the deal that the EFL wants as well. And one issue I am inevitably going to have with it is that when the money is allocated to the EFL, what's going to happen?
Spend more on players.
Exactly that, right? Because what you actually want is the money to go into capital sort of projects, developing the youth team, developing the stadium, all that sort of stuff, working within the community. But instead, the incentive within football is always, you go to the Simon Cooper thesis about performance, and it's pretty much linked directly to wages. So the more wages you have, the more you can spend on players, the more you win. And that is the essence of football throughout the pyramid, and that is what's ruining the actual game, because all the time teams want money so they can spend it on players, and you just have this inflationary process which gobbles up any sort of vestige of
tradition,
essence and tradition.
Well,
in the game,
FA Cup is supposed to be the antidote to everything you've just said,
and it's not, though, is it? It's not being that now. How do we make it that? I don't know, but
well, look, I'm sure we'll discuss that further on Thursday when Martin Samuel's on the podcast, and I'm sure we'll discuss it more and more, possibly around the final, and next season when it's all change. Anyway, okay, loads more to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest subscription offer.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome back to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. Joining me today are Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino and Hamza Khalik Lunat. To Goodison Park then, and the deduction derby, which did not disappoint. Well, the game itself might have disappointed a little bit, but there was plenty of drama in the sphere that matters. Official Twitter statements. The 2-0 win for Everton lifted Sean Dyche's team 5 points clear of the drop zone and left Forest a point above Luton and still deep in the mire. But the real drama unfolded after the game with the tweet by Nottingham Forest's official account, which read, "Three extremely poor decisions, three penalties not given, which we simply cannot accept. We warned the PGMOL that the VAR is a Luton fan before the game, but they didn't change him. Our patience has been tested multiple times. NFFC will now consider its options." So, Alison, let's be blunt about this. Basically, Nottingham Forest are insinuating that the VAR, Stuart Atwell, who didn't send the referee to the monitor for three potential penalties, which we shall come to, but they're insinuating he essentially that he's a cheat.
Yeah. I mean...
What can we possibly say about this?
What we can say is they're a club that are hurting. They're a club that are scared that they're going to go down. They're a club that are incensed that they've had a points deduction. They are a club in the sense that all season you could point to, as many clubs can, okay? But they are among those who can point to various incidents which have not gone their way. And their response to this, excuse me, has been quite extraordinary. They've hired Mark Clattenburg to be their referee consultant. I don't know what he's paid, but obviously feels he has to earn his money by in some way feeding these conspiracy theories. So it's they've created a conspiracy that where there wasn't one, and because the game was controversial and there were three quite blatant incidents that required at least some degree of analysis, it's fed into this conspiracy that they've created and the fact they've got Mark Clattenburg on the staff. So it's bizarre. It's like you have a you go and see a clairvoyant and they tell you, oh, you know, you're going to win the lottery. So you buy lots of tickets and then you don't win, but you don't blame the clairvoyant. You blame the lottery seller. It's all their fault. It is utterly bizarre. What I don't feel is that the public are going around queuing up for their coffees this morning thinking, ooh, I wonder if officials are biased and corrupt and have agendas. I don't think anyone's buying the idea that someone on VAR is deliberately manipulating affairs so that a club he has a soft spot for might benefit from the outcome that he's engineered, they'll simply be thinking, probably, VAR's rubbish, and we don't blame Forest for being cross, but it's a bit weird the way they're going about it.
But what they are doing, Tony, is calling Stuart Atwell's integrity into question.
Yeah.
Which is a serious thing to do.
Yeah, well, I often do this so much, I bring my own career in about having a crazy owner and Bernard Tapie, and he always has conspiracies on everything, and he once had a go at the media in France because all the accusations about what were happening behind the scenes of skullduggery at Marseille. And then he suddenly went, well, you're not even talking about Monaco, are you? They pay their players tax-free, foreign players. No one else in France does that. Isn't that a conspiracy? And I thought, that's a bit of a sore point. Laughed, because, you know. But what I'm trying to say is, the owner would have to be all over this. He had to be all over all over the Clattenburg being brought to the club. You know, obviously the relationship of Greece and him being Clattenburg working out in Greece. And I just feel like the owners okayed that. He has
the
to.
The owner's driven that.
Well, exactly. Sure. Well, there's probably the
better owner
word.
Probably dreamt it.
Yeah, he's driven this to be a conspiracy theory. And I find that you shouldn't be doing that. As an owner, you've got to be going, do you know what? We have to handle this in a different way. And do you know what happens in life a lot? Monday morning, we all wake up and we go, well, after the game yesterday, we all get up and we go, do you know what? How unfair was that on Nottingham Forest? We'd all talk about it. It's all going to be out there without even you having to say anything. Because we would be talking about, probably, I would say, out of the three penalty decisions that were obviously contentious, but I would say two, you're getting a pen. You're getting a pen on two occasions.
Which ones?
Well, so I thought Ashley Young handball. I've definitely thought that. And I thought the challenge by Ashley Young late on
Hudson-Odoi.
Yeah, Hudson-Odoi.
The first one not?
No, I didn't think that was a penalty. I thought that was too light. I just didn't think that would have been a soft penalty.
It was a bit of a dive.
Were any of them so egregious that it deserved a response like this? I know that's stupid. In fact, that's a stupid question. Nothing deserves a response like this. Was any of them so egregious that there should be this much commotion about it, actually? I would say
it's the cumulative effect, though.
I would say Hudson-Odoi's was the worst. The handball, you know, we saw one very similar being given against Wan-Bissaka. Wan-Bissaka in the same day.
Yeah. And Grealish in the semi-final. You know, that could have been a pen.
But there could have, would have. They're maybes. They're 50-50s. Yeah. The handball law is pretty nebulous these days. It's like, so. So, you know, there was one decision really that
this is why I mentioned the word conspiracy theory a lot, is because this is where they're letting themselves down, because there is a very grown up response to what happened with the officials in that game that does not require you to accuse an official of being biased. You can just say you're not applying VAR protocol properly here. You know, if that incident, the handball, that requires the referee to go and have a look at the monitor, because the handball rules here are just so vague and inconsistent. The only way you're going to get any semblance of a logical decision is for the referee to see it again. I mean, the most bizarre, and the reason they've let themselves down with conspiracy theory is because there's even a stronger case to get cross if you're Chelsea, because the referee in that game clearly cannot have seen the Grealish handball, because he didn't even give a corner. That meant he saw nothing at all. So VAR should have said, oh, you've seen nothing at all because you haven't even given a corner. You therefore need to go to the monitor. We're not telling you what to think about the handball, but because you saw nothing, why have a monitor if it's not allowing the referee to see a potential penalty incident that he did not see? And Chelsea could have put out a statement saying, this is an abject lack of care and attention, and, you know, the final should be replayed. It was appalling. That was really inconsistent and illogical application of VAR. And something similar could have been said by Forrest about why the referee was not encouraged to have another look at things. They did not need to make out that there's corruption at the heart of it.
Hamza, does it matter if an official supports a team? Should it matter? Should it be something that's cited or known about?
I don't think so. I mean, us four here, we all have club allegiances. I mean, you haven't even mentioned the Scottish
Cup
semi-final.
No one can guess who mine is.
I mean, which was an excellent match and probably deserves its own podcast of its own.
I like you more and more with every passing word, Hamza.
Joe Hart, if you don't know, Joe Hart actually missed a penalty. He decided to take one, he missed one, but the Celtic still won. but no, the point I was originally making is that all four of us here are asked to go to matches and come up with our thoughts about them and report them in a fair and honest way, and that's our job. And I believe if you listen to this, you trust us to do that. And likewise, you should be able to expect that a referee is able to do that too. I think it's silly that you can't expect a referee to put away their allegiances for 100 minutes now, because you have lots of added time. I think it's absolutely fine if you support a team. I mean, ideally, you probably should support a team and be involved in football, because it'd be weird if you didn't actually care about football and officiating football.
This is a valid point. I mean, we're so often referees are accused of not knowing the game. You know, like, he's never played the game, he doesn't know the game. The likelihood is, if he was a real football fan, like, you know, loves football and has grown up loving football, he will have an allegiance to a team. That's
exactly.
What do you want from people here?
I mean, years gone by, we knew that certain referees, you don't know the odd one, where he's from, and, you know, you might think he has a bias, you call him a cheat, or, you know. But
that's fine, Tony, isn't it?
But you would say in a moment, but to come out and make a statement, an official statement, by the club, that's tenfold more. That's the integrity of the guy, you know, trying to do an honest job. Because one thing's for sure, comparing it to other leagues around the world, the Premier League is certainly one of the most regulated and more honest. You know, I see performances of teams, and there is a part of me, I remember playing certain games and teams did sort of have their flip-flops on at the end of the season, because some of the players were going in, they'd openly speak in the newspaper and say, I'm leaving this summer. And I'd say, but you're under contract for 2 years. And they'd say, no, I've had an agreement with the club, I'm leaving. And think it was... That would never have happened in the top flight in England. You know, where players and just... I just think integrity's always been there. I think it's very hard to find anything that Nottingham Forest have indicated. I think that's really... And Hamza made a really... But I was thinking this on the way in, and thinking, I'm a Liverpool fan, but my duty's not to Liverpool. My duty is to the newspaper and all the other football clubs and give an honest assessment of a football game. Sometimes I don't like it. Of course, we don't like it when we lose and we get bitter and angry. But still, my primary concern must be what my column's going to be about, is what I see. And sometimes I can be a harsh critic. And I've been accused many a time of not being a Liverpool fan because people think I'm too harsh.
Well, to answer your original question, though, Gregor, I think it's okay for a referee to be not appointed to officiate a game where he grew up as a staunch Man City fan. That's absolutely fine. But you can't then start extrapolating, well, if you grew up a City fan, you probably don't like that club. And you probably, oh yeah, you know, 10 years ago, that club knocked you out of that competition. You probably don't like them. You can't, there'll be a long, long list.
And do it about the VARs at Stockley Park, not just the referees. Yeah. It's a minefield.
There'll be too long a list of reasons why. You know, like Trump and his jury picking in America. You know, there'll be too many reasons why that particular official won't be appropriate.
His brother's son's at Lincoln, it's endless. You could find nearly something on everyone.
And Mark Glattenberg's the man who's got all the juicy knowledge about everyone. I mean,
exactly.
What
I don't get.
Gary Neville said he should resign, and like.
Should
he be allowed to? Should this position be allowed?
No,
to exist.
To exist. That's the question.
No, I would say no. I think it.
And then, as well as him now,
as well as him
giving his view in his newspaper column the next day.
Yeah. No, it's as appropriate
what kind of world are
as
we living
a
in
club
here?
Saying they've got an official stripper. It's a joke.
No, if he was a consultant that would have been brought in every now and again to educate the players on the rules of the game and the benefits,
that's part of his job, we should say. That is part of his job.
Yeah. Yeah. Which
also
is fine.
To lobby.
But it's a way different line. He knows he can't say nothing against what the owner would think and the agenda, what they're putting out there. He cannot. Because he'd be out of his job in a heartbeat.
I would contend that this is, well, it is an extreme. I don't think it's something new. Clubs and managers have always sought to where they can, not all of them, but they've sought where they can to apply pressure to referees. And if they don't like a particular referee, they'll try and make sure that they're not doing their matches. Sir Alex Ferguson, for example, was quite sort of forthright in this. I mean, Jurgen Klopp has named a few referees that he, and one in particular that he doesn't really like. Clubs do this because...
Hamza?
Yeah.
I've been on the football field and before kickoff, who's the ref today? Like we're in the dressing room and someone's gone, oh, it sounds, oh no, not him. You know, we feel like he's given the other team an advantage, which is, you know, that's just a general sort of thing that goes on.
But this is different to calling someone's
this is way different.
I just think it's an extension of that. I don't think it's too different. I just think this is taking it to a new extreme. And then once you go beyond this extreme, you then get...
What's next?
Turkey. Have you been listening to Martin Ziegler's podcast that he does? Because every now and then him and his, Rob Harris and Tarik Pandya just give an update of what's happening going on in Turkey. And you've got clubs there which I can't remember the exact team, but they're in the cup final and they conceded in the first minute. They walked off. They sort of surrendered it out of protest because of their sort of. And they also held a vote to leave the league. they're all fans in, and they held a vote. So I think everyone sort of raised their arms to say that they wanted to stay in the league. But yeah, that's the next sort of logical sort of, but also kind of mental step that goes on. But yeah, I think this sort of stuff is just an extension of what already exists. And where do we draw the line? I don't know, but probably not using a bit of common sense and not doing tweets like this would probably help.
To the relegation battle then, what does this mean? There's some really fascinating results this weekend. Luton going down 5-1 to Brentford, who now look very much safe.
They were never in trouble, Gregor.
And Burnley 4-1 against Sheffield United. Tony, where does this leave the relegation battle? There's hope for Burnley after all we've said on this podcast over the season. There is a glimmer of hope now.
Well, they've had a few games of late, haven't they? I mean, I was thinking of the Brighton game, you know, where they were 1-0 up and then the goalkeeper's made a horrendous mistake.
Yeah. Well, he was excellent in this game.
Yeah, he was excellent. Made two or three big saves against Sheffield United early on in the match. Yeah, Morwich. But he made a big mistake against Brighton, which cost them two really valuable points. There's something about Vincent Kompany seems to be always fighting against... I mean, he's had 2 years of massive turnover in his dressing room because they've let loads of players go. They've had to replace them. They've had to come up from the Premier League. And then once they've been a Premier League team, they then have got to do another dressing room to improve players. They've had major issues. Players like Foster have gone not been available because he's had issues with mental health. And, you know, it feels like he's been battling all the way. They were really good in the end. I thought they were really, really... Just, you know, Josh Cullen's a player I like and... watched him quite a bit, and I think he's always looked like he's trying to prove a point that he's ready for this level, you know. Mm-hmm. But Kompany's got them involved somehow. He's just, and at times they can be pretty. I mean, they will take a hiding, you know. But then Sheffield United have been the kings of that all season, haven't they? Really.
Here's a question though: for most of the season, I think people have said things like, "If Rob Edwards can keep Luton up, he's manager of the season." But if Vincent Kompany was to keep Burnley up, no one would be saying he's manager of the season.
No,
and yet, equally ridiculous outcomes would deserve some accolade. It's because Burnley have looked naive and haven't been as entertaining. They haven't had the story
and they
behind.
Spent okay,
but to get out of it now would be phenomenal. It would be phenomenal, but I don't think we'd be as romantic about it.
You can't give manager the season for someone who's done a bad job and then does a good job to get him out of that bad job.
Like, that's what I'm asking.
The good manager in the first place just wouldn't be in that situation, right?
Yeah.
Right, I'm in the chair, so I get to say who's going down, who's staying up. Do you think anyone, like Luton or Burnley, will actually pull clear or Forest will drop below the waterline?
I'm going for the three teams that got promoted last year to go
back
down.
You still think it'll be the same?
Yeah,
I still think. I think there's a danger with what's happened over the weekend that Forest might implode, because it is beyond the joke.
Hamza?
I don't know. It probably. What am I? Nostradamus.
You're sitting in my chair, actually, so this is quite fitting that you kind of.
I don't know. Just
show your contempt of the prediction game.
Mike, yeah, probably as it is. I don't know. Yeah, something like that.
Okay. To the title race then, which I'm sure the three of you.
What's yours, Gregor? You're bottom three.
I kind of agree. I think Forrest are in a bit of a tailspin actually now, and this sort of siege mentality that they're trying to build might have a negative effect. But I'm with you, really. Deep down, who knows? Anyway, let's go to the title race. Big 2-0 win for Arsenal against Wolves. Goals from Leo Trossard and Martin Odegaard at the end of both halves. Sixth game in 18 days for Arsenal, and after a very bruising week for them, huge result to get to kind of show that they've still got a fight in this title race, Hamza.
Yeah, but as you'd expect, it's Wolves. Wolves are good, but Arsenal are better, and they've shown that over the course of the season. So yeah,
that's Hamza's audition for why bother doing a podcast.
You just want to get to Liverpool, you three.
Why would we want to get to Liverpool?
Yeah, okay.
I was at Craven Cottage there, so I will speak from a
I can do more City stuff if you want. So Pep was complaining about fixture congestion, and he's entirely right to, actually. I think it's silly, the amount of the demands that are placed on players. I think it's a question of player welfare. In no other job would you be expected to actually put your in most other jobs you wouldn't be expected to put your body into sort of physical harm and know that you're going to do that. So when players are playing 2 days after a match, ideally that's meant to be the day that you rest. There's a study that came out a few months ago. I put in my piece just after the international break. This guy used to work for PSG, now works as a consultant for UEFA, said that the most important day is match day plus two, and that's an off-feet day. So you're just meant to do massage work, stuff like that. And if you play on that day, your risk of injury jumps to like 40%. Meanwhile, these players are just asked to play more and more and more and more, and the spectacle is worse for it. I mean, take a look at that City match I was on about earlier. Very good, was it? I mean, take a look at the Arsenal match. That wasn't very good either.
Well, having said all that, this is a big win for Arsenal then, Hamza. You should be showing more enthusiasm about that.
Well,
a gutsy win.
Arsenal are quite fortunate that they've had very few players injured this season, other than Timber and Jesus for a bit. So yeah, they should win.
Yeah, but this is a huge week for Arsenal. They've got Chelsea at home on Tuesday, and then the North London Derby at the weekend. I think I think the way the fixtures fall as well, they could have quite a big advantage over City before the weekend as well. So before Thursday, I think City play. Sorry. So this could well be the pivotal week for Arsenal, and to win this game after a bruising week, as I said, did show character, Alison.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and. It's easy to say it when you've watched the match unfold, but they probably did exactly the right thing, which was that they took it very cautiously. Arteta knew that they might be hurting a bit emotionally and be tired, as Hamza points out. They didn't go at it. They weren't over-emotional in the first half at all. It was quite plodding. But I felt that was deliberate. Let's just get the rhythm going again, brush away the cobwebs of going out of the Champions League. But I am with Hamza. I mean, Wolves have been a surprising story this season, but they were depleted.
They had a 15-year-old on the bench.
Cunha, Neto, two big players.
The best players weren't on the pitch. Yeah. And so they, a team with Arsenal's resources and lack of injuries, it would have been absolutely ridiculous for them to have lost that. So it was useful.
Let's get to Craven Cottage.
It was a useful win, but I don't. And yes, it prepares them for two very, very big games coming up. But
okay, to Liverpool then.
I was at Craven Cottage, and I, as you may have gathered, I'm ridiculously optimistic when it comes to Liverpool. But I didn't go there feeling optimistic at all. Actually, recent Liverpool performances I felt have been quite unattractive and unappealing and overly chaotic and overly emotional. So what a relief. Klopp put out a team that were largely unemotional, fairly solid, sensible, grown up, serene, touch of an aura about them. they just went about their business at a ground which has produced some shocks, and Fulham have really tested Liverpool this season. Maybe it's hard for Fulham to really get going when they're not in any danger and aren't in anything to sort of grasp. But what was so impressive was all that overdoing it. Randomness had gone. The passing was sensible, intelligent, crisp. They were largely in fourth gear, never fifth gear, but it was exactly what was needed after a period where it sort of looked like it was going to implode. So I'm not saying Liverpool will necessarily now win the league, but I think they look like they're capable of winning all their remaining games.
Tony, you thought that they might fall away quite badly.
Yeah, I was surprised by the lineup. Not because I think he had to make changes. He did. But I thought what was evident for the game was Liverpool's finishing has been woeful in recent weeks. And that all three finishes, I know with Trent, obviously from a free kick, top corner, well, okay, that he can do that, so we know that. But I also thought Gravenberch, his finish was a great one on the edge of the box. And then Jota, who can get scruffy goals. I love it. I want to see centre forwards getting scruffy goals. Where he's got it out of his feet. Nunes, if he'd have been in that position, he's either hitting the keeper, or, you know, nearly taking his head off, or wide over the bar, or whatever. And I thought that was more. I felt far more comfortable with that type of win against Fulham with their finishing, because it felt like a bit more of accomplished teams. And one thing we touched on earlier about all the football. Football now is an extreme fitness. Okay, so the elite teams, there are many teams in top flight football all over the world, are so extremely fit. Footballers are made completely different from years gone by. And when you're running and running and running all this time, game after game after game, you've just seen in the last few weeks, Arsenal take an alarming dip. They were physically, alarmingly, for me, not the same team. Liverpool, likewise. Man City they've got the way better of Madrid, but they still miss something in their physical side, and I thought it showed against Chelsea. So they're all suffering from what's happened over the month of April. They definitely are in the last month. I think that stood out for me. What will Klopp's lineup be in the next game? I think that will be really interesting, because he left a few out. You know, he's changed the team slightly. Salah being on the bench. You know, Gakpo played on the left. Diaz was on the right. I thought he really mixed it up yesterday. And Nunes left out as well. You know, McAllister didn't start. Now, I don't know the team, but it makes me think now that it's not a certain starting 11 at Liverpool now as they go into the final games, because he's witnessed the way Liverpool have played in recent weeks, and he's gone, I'm going to play Harvey Elliott. I'm going to play him in now.
I didn't think Liverpool were that good.
No, they weren't. I'm not saying they were. Yeah. I thought the finishes were pivotal.
I agree, yeah. I thought it was just some good finishing after a period in which their finishing was diabolical. I mean, did I write this? I don't know if I did.
Only you know, Hamza.
I might have. I think I gave it to Paul Joyce. They had a 10-match period where they were averaging 2.81 expected goals per match, and that sort of was up to the Palace match, I think. And 2.81 is the third highest total ever under Klopp over a 10-match period, and it has only been surpassed twice, 2.82 at two earlier points this season. Amazing attacking sort of output numbers. Yet their finishing has been utterly dreadful in that period. So, like, they're creating more chances than ever and just weren't finishing them. And in this match, they created one XG, their lowest XG total since they lost to Arsenal, the 3-1 match in February. Yeah.
That's in output titles,
terms,
right?
In output terms, they didn't create that much. I didn't think they were that good on the ball. I thought they're a bit calmer. But they took their chances, which they didn't do over the past 3-4 matches, which has sort of derailed their season. And the United match as well, which sort of derailed the season very slightly. Football is a bit sort of random. I did a piece last week where I spoke to David Sumpton. He said, like, football, essentially, it's like flipping a coin. Good teams get to flip the coin more times than others. So, like, if you're Man City, you get to flip the coin. Typically, there's, like, three coin tosses in a match. And the good team will probably get two coin tosses and the bad team will get one. But if you don't call it right, you could still lose. And a good team like City will probably get five coin tosses to Luton's two. But five coin tosses to two, you can still lose. And I think that's sort of what's happened here with Liverpool. The coin tosses went their way in this game.
Does that mean you get five kickoffs? I'm confused.
But yeah. Okay. They're all right. That Trent kid, he's like quite clearly like the best right back in the world.
He's so darned inverted. It's quite funny to watch.
He's really good, isn't he? When he plays like centre midfielder,
but there were often gaps on the right, and you thought, well, it'd be quite nice if we had a fullback there.
Yes, so. But that's fun to watch, isn't it?
One point. You know, when you talked about the PSG thing with time off and 48 hours after a game and resting, Brian Clough famously, many times, would call the players, and I spoke to Teddy Sheringham about this. They'd play a game on the Saturday, come in on the Monday, train, and he'd say, see you all Friday. And they'd be like, we've got a game. He said, no, don't want anyone in. Don't want to see any faces. See you Friday for training. And it'll be sharp and quick. And be ready again for the Saturday. Now, again, that's a different era. But there's actually quite a lot of managers who are still doing that time off thing, thinking it's just as important, as hard as your training. They're saying you have to switch off because you can't keep hitting or pushing that pedal right to the ground all the time.
Sounds like the game podcast. We're going to have to switch off now. And I'll take some time off and we'll see you Thursday. Thank you, Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino, Hamza Khalid Lunat. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you're subscribed. Leave us a review. We will be back on Thursday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.